I will say, much as I love the CNN, you're doing a disservice.
Well, that's what they do. That
is CNN.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, in Oregon on 91.7 FM KYAQ on the Central Coast, and 106.7 FM KSO in Cottage Grove, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania on 92.9 FM WLRI, in Maui, Hawaii on 88.5 FM KAKU, in Palinville, New York on 102.9 FM WLPP, in Columbus, Ohio on 94.1 WGRN, in Grand Rapids, Michigan on WPRR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950. We're also heard streaming coast to coast and around the globe on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR, Revolution 99, Detour Talk, Radio Monterey, and Radio Sputnik, blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow. Says me from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up, I've been getting some very interesting reaction to my interview yesterday with Massachusetts Institute of Technology. That's MIT, in case you don't know. MIT Professor Emeritus Ted Postol, regarding his analyses questioning the evidence released by the White House on April 11 to justify its unconstitutional and unauthorized and perhaps illegal under international law bombing campaign against Syria on April 6, which was itself in response to the alleged Syrian chemical attack in a rebel-held province on April 4. Postal's scientific reports argue that the White House claims are completely unfounded. And in fact, he says the evidence cited by the White House, even if taken at face value, offers no proof of who was actually responsible for that nerve agent incident. Perhaps we'll discuss some of those responses on tomorrow's show if I get some time. I'll even try to open up the phone lines as well tomorrow. But why have Postol's claims not even been covered by the U.S. media, given his long track record of being right on these things, even to debunk them? Why have they not been, you know, debunked by the mainstream media? We will discuss that and more concerns about the U.S. government claims against Syria with independent investigative journalist Robert Perry of Consortium News shortly. But very quickly here, a couple of other items. Two people were killed in Arkansas on Monday night by the state of Arkansas. Two inmates received lethal injections on the very same gurney on Monday night, about 3 hours apart. Arkansas completed the nation's first double execution since 2000, just days after the state ended a nearly 12-year hiatus on capital punishment there. The first inmate, Jack Jones, was executed on schedule shortly after 7 p.m., but attorneys for the second man, Marcel Williams, had convinced a federal judge minutes later to briefly delay his execution due to concerns about how the first one was carried out. Officials spent some 45 minutes trying to place an IV line into Jones' neck, trying to kill him before they placed it elsewhere. And they argued that Williams, who weighed 400 pounds, could have faced a torturous death because of his weight. Jack Jones was seen moving his lips and gulping for air, according to AP's reporter who witnessed the execution. He moved his lips briefly after the midazolam was administered. That is one of the three drugs used to kill people in Arkansas, and it is the reason why the governor there, Asa Hutchinson, had scheduled four double executions over an 11-day period this month. Because the supply of midazolam was going to expire as of the end of this month. So, quick, kill them all in a hurry. Besides those two executions on Monday, Arkansas put to death one other inmate last week and has one more scheduled for Thursday of this week. Four of the others have been blocked by the courts. So far they've got 3 out of 10. Nice going, Arkansas. Keep up the good killing. In happier news, hello, Desi Doyen. You'll cheer me up. We didn't get to talk about this yesterday on the show. Coming out of the weekend, the marches for science all over, not just all over the country, but all over the world, brought out hundreds of thousands of scientists.
Yes, they did.
And their supporters, people like you who believe in that science stuff. I love there was a couple of signs. You got to love when scientists go marching, when scientists go protesting. Their signs were absolutely fantastic in many cases. Some of the favorites, this one, and look how scientific these are. This woman, cost of Trump's border wall, $31.2 billion. National Institute of Health's entire 2016 budget, $31.3 billion. They cost the same, but one is far more valuable, says this woman marching with this sign. Another woman who looks like she was there with also a scientific related sign. The dollars of one weekend at Mar-a-Lago equal funding for three National Institute of Health research grants for 4.5 years, providing 9+ jobs, 22 scientific findings, and $7.4 million in local economic growth. That was all on,
all on one sign.
And because apparently she's a scientist, in letters at the bottom, it says calculations and citations can be found at... And then it lists her Twitter address.
Vicky
Bartsch is her name. Thank you, Vicky. Well done.
Leave it to the scientists to cite their sources.
No doubt. Yeah, exactly. But the one you found, Des, was perhaps the best and maybe the most chilling. This one, at the start of every disaster movie, there's a scientist being ignored.
Yes, that was my favorite by far.
That is kind of perfect.
But hey, we don't learn anything. We don't learn anything from our movies. We don't learn anything from our experience. We don't learn. Hey, you know, we've got all this data and all this science. Why not use it? Oh, no, that's a crazy idea.
That scientist, he warned us. We should have listened, as they always say in those movies. Well, I'm happy to report that all of the broadcast network news shows on Saturday evening, at least, covered the March for Science as their lead story. Good for them. I mean, there was hundreds of thousands of people marching across the world. Good for the evening news on the networks, in any event, covering that as their lead story on Saturday night. That's good. But there were a couple of outlets that, even after all of these years, still seem to have been wooed by the siren song of fossil fuel-funded denialism. CNN, hello CNN, CNN's New Day Saturday featured a guest panel discussing the marches that included Bill Nye, the science guy, and a physicist, William Happer, who is a climate change denier. Happer was allowed to perpetuate the myth that carbon dioxide is not a harmful pollutant and that it benefits that it actually benefits the planet.
Yeah, I know.
He claimed incorrectly that temperatures are not rising as fast as climate models predicted. Called for the cancellation of the Paris Climate Agreement because it, quote, doesn't make any scientific sense. It's just a silly thing, he said. And he went on to compare it to the Munich Agreement and the British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain's appeasement of Hitler.
Yeah.
That's what he complained. I think is he with the Heartland? Oh, no, that was the other guy with the Heartland. Here was some of William Happer on CNN.
You know, there's this myth that's developed around carbon dioxide that it's a pollutant. But you and I both exhale carbon dioxide with every breath. So each of us emits about 2 pounds of carbon dioxide a day. So are we polluting the planet?
Yes.
Carbon dioxide is a perfectly natural gas. It's just like water vapor. It's something that plants love. They grow better with more carbon dioxide. And you can see the greening of the earth already from the additional carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
So at least he's admitting there's more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. But he says it's a myth that CO2 is a pollutant because we all exhale that.
And of course, that's not what scientists are talking about. They're talking about the digging up and burning of sequestered carbon that the Earth has sequestered in its own processes over eons. And we're digging it up and re-releasing it into the atmosphere. We're not talking about people exhaling. That's not even a part of the calculation.
But this notion that CO2 cannot be a pollutant because we exhale it, and would we consider that a pollutant? Well, you know, as I said before, this guy Happer, let's put him in a room with that non-pollutant, with only CO2, and see how long he lasts. And so, you know, we do expel about 2 pounds of CO2 a day. I don't know about you, but I also urinate several times a day, and I'm pretty sure he would not like all of that urine in his drinking water, in his food. So this idea that CO2 is not a pollutant, you know, if he was a real scientist, he would understand that toxins are not measured. Toxins are measured by the amount.
Right.
We did a story a couple of weeks ago about a woman who died from drinking too much water. Now, obviously, water is not considered a pollutant, but if you have too much of it, it becomes a problem.
Right. The dose makes the poison is what a toxicologist would say. Now, he also said a couple of things that were just outright lies. He lied about the climate models. They are actually, in reality, substantially showing exactly what the models had predicted is what we're seeing now. And that's actually a bit scary because what the models are showing, we're seeing sooner than the models projected. And also he said that that CO2 is good for plants, and that's true. So, you know, plants take in CO2, they put out oxygen. The problem with that idea is that too much CO2, studies have shown, actually retards the growth of plants and reduces their yield. And that's really important if you need plants for food like we do.
So they gave this, you know, this platform to this guy, along with the Bill Nye, the science guy, and one other woman, and I'm sorry I missed her name, from 350.org. So there was three people on this panel. Two of them were not deniers. One of them was. But Bill Nye, his response to actually even having this guy on at all, I think was kind of perfect.
And I will say, much as I love the CNN, you're doing a disservice by having one climate change skeptic and not 97 or 98 scientists or engineers concerned about climate change.
Exactly.
Yep.
If you wanted to accurately tell the story, you'd have one denier and 97 or 98 scientists responding to him. But that's not what they do. Not on the CNN, apparently, where denialism is almost as true, as worthy of their time as non-denialism. Same thing, a similar story over on CBS. They covered the marches, but they also aired a segment in which they featured Joe Bast, this guy from the Heartland Institute, a climate-denying organization funded by fossil fuel industry.
And just so as you know, yeah. Joe Bast is not a scientist.
No, he's not. He's a propagandist who says stuff like this.
Besides, he says, climate change isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Cold weather kills more people than warm weather does. So on net, more people would benefit in a warmer climate.
So there you go.
So not true. I mean,
no, it's totally true. Every member of the Heartland Institute should jump into a volcano because they'll totally benefit from that warmer climate.
How much warmer it actually is. So basically, they just completely ignored what the study author said, what the study actually says, in order to turn it to their own incorrect ideological goals.
Heartland Institute misleading the American public? Say it ain't so. Of course, they would But the fact that CBS, they did note that most climate scientists, the United Nations, as well as NASA, dismissed these arguments as propaganda for fossil fuels. But again, you know, they treated him legitimately, and they did not report that Heartland is funded by fossil fuel interests, including the Koch brothers and Exxon. They should have. And in any event, so kudos to those network newscasts that did cover this properly on Saturday night. But by Sunday, on all of the network Sunday morning news shows, ABC This Week, CBS Face the Nation, NBC Meet the Press, they failed to mention the March for Science at all. That according to Media Matters. Now, do you suppose if there had been hundreds of thousands of Tea Partiers out marching all across the country on Saturday, that it would have been completely ignored on all the Sunday morning news shows? Of course not. Media Matters, of course, had a study, a recent study, finding that in 2016, when we needed them most, the network news broadcast completely failed us, as well as Fox News. They decreased their total coverage of climate change by 66% in 2016 compared to the year before. And the year before, they were already very busy ignoring climate change. But yeah. In 2016, when we had a presidential election and could have really used their coverage, they were ignored. The issue was completely ignored in the presidential election.
A real failure.
Speaking of scientists being ignored, MIT professor emeritus of science, technology, and national security policy, Theodore Postol's analysis of the White House evidence used to justify its attack on Syria has also been ignored by the U.S. corporate media. Robert Perry of Consortium News joins me next to explain why. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. All right, welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Yesterday on the Bradcast, I interviewed MIT Professor Emeritus of Science, Technology, and National Security Policy, Professor Theodore Postol, about his numerous analyses. I believe he's up to four now, questioning the evidence or lack thereof included in the declassified White House report, which is not an intelligence community assessment, but a White House report issued a few days after Donald Trump bombed a Syrian airbase with 59 Tomahawk cruise missiles in response to the chemical attack allegedly carried out by Bashar al-Assad in the rebel-held Idlib province in Syria. That attack was said to have killed some 80 civilians and injured many others. Professor Postol, however, argues that the evidence in the White House report does not support the claims that the White House is making about the nerve agent incident, which, he says, could not possibly have been carried out in the way the White House charges. And in any event, that report, he says, includes absolutely no evidence about who actually carried out the attack. There has been just about zero discussion of Professor Postol's analyses. Despite his credentials, he was formerly the science advisor to the Naval Operations Chief at the Pentagon, among other things. And despite his track record going back to the 90s, when he correctly identified that the Pentagon had misrepresented the supposed success rate of the U.S. Patriot missile system, having shot down Scud missiles fired by Iraq in the first Gulf War. In fact, the system did not work as the U.S. had initially claimed. Postol was vindicated on that, but the facts came out only after the Patriot missile system won so much praise that Congress appropriated millions of dollars more to the defensive weapons system. Postol's analyses concerning the April 4 nerve agent incident in Syria have been ignored by the mainstream media, which, he noted, is curious since everyone from the New York Times on down used to cite his work. Now, he told me on yesterday's show that he's heard no response from them, from the New York Times or anyone else in the mainstream corporate media about his reports on this. That seems curious to me, and it seemed curious to him given that we have now gone to war against a sovereign nation with no independent body confirming charges of chemical weapons used in Syria that I know of. The charges were made initially by an Al-Qaeda-affiliated group in the area, and there's been no debate, much less authorization, from the U.S. Congress to go to war with a sovereign nation in the first place. Moreover, Syria is said to be doing well in its civil war right now against the rebels and the terrorist groups in recent months, since their Russian allies have joined them in that fight. So why would they risk international outrage by launching a chemical attack against civilians when it doesn't seem to have been really necessary militarily? So what really happened in that incident in Khan Shaykhun, seen across the world in those horrific video footage images cited by Donald Trump as the reason he was willing to change his years-long position, supposedly against taking military action against the Assad government? I have no idea. I have no idea what really happened. I was not there, and so far we have no independent investigative report finding anything really one way or another that is backed up by evidence. Nonetheless, even Democrats appear to be in favor of Trump's attack on Syria. Congress is still not debating the issue to give legal, constitutional authorization for Trump's action. And the U.S. media, right, left, and center, seem to think even discussing concerns about the evidence or the lack thereof issued by the White House to support the administration's claims that Assad gassed his own people is out of bounds, even as it could lead to yet another endless U.S. war in the Middle East. There is once again absolutely no discussion of the counter narrative to the administration's claims. So what the hell is going on here? And why is there zero debate about it or coverage in the U.S. media even to debunk Professor Postol's claims? Joining me now is someone who has been asking some of these very same questions about the U.S. media, and someone who comes from the U.S. media, albeit now the independent, non-corporate U.S. media. Robert Perry is the creator and editor of ConsortiumNews.com, which was founded in 1995 as the first investigative news magazine on the internet. Perry was formerly an Associated Press reporter who, in the mid-1980s, helped to expose the Iran-Contra scandal, among other things. Robert Perry, sir, welcome to the broadcast.
Thanks, Brad. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. I noted today that in the as I was looking around ConsortiumNews.com, looking at the About section, that you described the site as having been created in the 90s, quote, as a home for important, well-reported stories and a challenge to the inept but dominant mainstream news media of the day. I guess you were talking about the 90s, and you explained that you were distressed by this silliness and propaganda that had come to pervade American journalism, and founded the site in response to your fear that the decline of the U.S. Press Corps foreshadowed disasters that would come when journalists failed to alert the public about impending dangers. Before we discuss whether that seems to be happening or has happened here in the Syria matter, has the dominant mainstream news media, as you regard them, become any less inept as you see it since launching Consortium News back in the 90s?
Oh, I'm sorry to say that they probably became more inept if you consider that the goal should be to thoroughly, adequately inform the American people about important events. What we're seeing is that again and again, the mainstream press is now acting almost as if it has a duty to prevent the American people from hearing the other side of a story. When I was a young journalist, and certainly my time with the AP and other places, we were taught that there is almost always two sides to a story, and often more than that.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's approached that there's only one side to the story, that if the White House or the State Department gives you a statement, that's it. And if you even question it, or if you listen to other points of view, you're somehow violating a responsibility to just to brush aside or ignore or debunk any counter argument to what the State Department or the U.S. government is saying. It's a And there's almost a pride being taken now by the New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN and others in ignoring the other side of a story. And I know they've sort of mixed it up with this idea that Trump has raised about alternative facts. And there are things that are factual and should be respected as such. But often in a complicated issue, we certainly see this in the detective stories you watch on TV, mm-hmm. that sometimes the initial impression is not the correct one, that anyone with any intellectual honesty tries to keep parsing what's available and figuring out what is believable and what isn't, and not just taking the word of some government agency, no matter how much confidence they may express in their point of view. And that's, we've seen now a recurring situation. We had the case of the Iraq War, where you might have thought, well, after that, the New York Times and the Washington Post and others will be more skeptical and more self-critical about the need to show skepticism. But that hasn't happened. In fact, it's gone increasingly in the other direction.
Which is particularly curious, I would add, with the rise of Donald Trump. In some respect, I wouldn't be surprised. I even wasn't surprised when, under Obama, they sort of accepted the government line. It was troubling coming right after George W. Bush and the Iraq fiasco. But I sort of understood it. But here you've got Donald Trump, who has issued one piece of nonsense after another. Every word he utters is just, ridiculous. And yet he sends 59 Tomahawk cruise missiles into Syria, and everyone is, regard him. Today's the day he became the president. And, they don't even question the White House reports. I find that sort of doubly curious. That they haven't even learned to know better following the Iraq War, much less all the lies they've been told by Donald Trump.
Yeah, that is an odd one, Brad, because I've noted that too, that for the first 2 months or so of his presidency, everything he said was put under a microscope and often laughed at, mm-hmm. and often rightly so. He claimed that his inaugural crowds were bigger than Obama's when they clearly weren't. He's gone on about how he won the popular vote when he clearly lost it. And so there's been this attitude that this guy is not to be trusted on anything he says, yet he immediately jumps to a conclusion way before there could have been any serious intelligence analysis mm-hmm. of it, that Assad was responsible for this incident. And the mainstream media completely flipped around and just rallied to his position and then refused to listen to any alternative points of view on this. And there are some serious points of view. Much of the argument that the mainstream media has made about Assad's supposed motive, that he was doing this, even though it seems to make no sense to you and me, mm-hmm. but he was doing it because he was demonstrating his impunity, that no one would hold him accountable. It was like a victory dance of some sort. But then why would he deny doing it? If you're trying to announce your impunity,
right.
you wouldn't then say, I didn't do it. So much of this doesn't make any sense, and the claims are coming from essentially Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda and its propaganda network, and it's a very sophisticated propaganda network that Al-Qaeda and these radical Islamic groups have going on in Syria and elsewhere. So there should be all kinds of reasons to be highly suspicious. Now, if the U.S. intelligence community had some hard evidence, i.e. they intercepted an order from Assad to his people, drop the sarin bomb, that's one thing. But if they did have that, they would have told us. We would have heard that. But we haven't. We've heard suggestions that they have some other information that they just can't share with us. But that should set up all kinds of alarm bells. In the past, as I've pointed out, when presidents are faced with similar situations, they have gone they've gone the extra mile in releasing what had been classified material. Kennedy, obviously, with the U-2 surveillance photos of mm-hmm. the Cuban Missile Crisis in '62. Even Ronald Reagan in '83 released that the United States could intercept Soviet ground-to-air commands, that because in the case of the KAL 007 flight, It's also true that the Reagan people doctored the tapes, but they acknowledged that they could do this. Mm-hmm. So the sources and methods are often set aside in the need to convince the world community that the United States has the goods. In this case, there has been nothing like that, nothing. And there's been a reliance on this information that has been put out by Al-Qaeda, photographs that don't make any sense, mm-hmm. people supposedly climbing into the Sarin crater with virtually no protective gear and having no consequence from it.
Mm-hmm.
And these are things that Postal has pointed out and others. But the bigger issue to me has been that there has been no evidence presented. And this idea of saying trust us, has really worn thin.
Yep.
At least for me it has. I've been around Washington since 1977, and I've been lied to a lot by the government. And so at a certain point you say, okay, I'd like to trust you, but I don't.
Right.
It's up to you. You've got to start presenting me with credible evidence. But instead, we've gotten into this pattern, and we saw it under Obama, too, by the way, where he would make assertions where he's supposedly supported by the intelligence community, but they would not present their evidence. And some of it turned out to be very shaky. The previous sarin case in Syria comes to mind,
right.
in 2013, which also collapsed under examination. Although, and even Obama has kind of at times said, yes, we never, you know, the intelligence community told me there was no, quote, slam dunk evidence that, blaming Assad. But then the Washington Press Corps, the national media, which bought into that one too, just has continued to say that that's true. I mean, there's now this strange dichotomy between what is sort of established as historical fact and what Washington insiders want to believe. There are like two parallel senses of reality. There's, mm-hmm. there's the real reality that we've been able to sort of ferret out. People like Cy Hirsch did some work. Postal did some good work on it in the 2013 case. And then there's what the conventional wisdom is, or the groupthink, and they don't connect. But that has become the pattern that we have seen, and it's very dangerous. It's particularly dangerous now that Donald Trump has realized that, hey, if I want to get the press off my back on something, because they were hounding him, as you remember, every day about so-called Russiagate.
Mm-hmm.
He suddenly fires off some missiles, some of which hit the target, and some went astray apparently and killed some civilians. But he was widely applauded for this. What we're seeing is a very strange situation where the National Press Corps is putting its hatred of Assad and its desire for regime change in Syria even above its contempt for Donald Trump and all his lies.
which is a tall bar. And that's what bothers me. That's what bothers me about this report, about going to war against a sovereign nation without actually having independently verifiable evidence, you know, evidence that is checkable, that, you know, and I have the same problem when it comes to the accusations against Donald Trump concerning Russia. It's as if, you know, if the intelligence community in some fashion says, well, we can't divulge anymore because of sources and methods, but here's our conclusion. Republicans, Democrats, the U.S. media, they all go, oh, OK, well, then I understand you can't. So we'll just go with your conclusions. You never mind having to prove them. Well, we end up in these endless wars. You cite Robert Perry in your article last week, headline, Did Al-Qaeda Fool the White House Again? You cite one smug CNN commentator, that's your quote, who pontificated that we all know what happened in 2013. And that refers back to the alleged sarin attack that year, said to have killed hundreds near Damascus, also attributed to the Assad government. Again, I don't know if it happened or not, or how it happened, or who was responsible for it. But at least at that time, the Obama administration said, okay, let's leave this to Congress then. I'd like to respond militarily to Syria, but let's let Congress decide whether to give me authorization or not as per the Constitution. They never did, by the way. They never even debated it, despite their criticism of Obama's policies in Syria. They did not step up. But we get this sort of this body of information that is taken for granted. CNN says, oh, we all know what happened in 2013. And it sort of builds on itself to the point where I think it's too easy to go to war, especially with this evidence that has not ever actually been independently verified.
Right. And it's not even a problem. We supposedly look for independent sourcing. Even like the UN now has become so cowed by the pressures from the West. Its investigators are not at this point even being very honest themselves. There's a lot of careerism that comes into this. There's been a very ugly history, if you go back especially to the Bush years, mm-hmm. of purging these various agencies, like the Chemical Weapons Program and Committee itself, of leadership that had somehow challenged U.S. positions. So what you often end up with, even with U.N. investigations, are these really bizarre sort of phony investigations, which sort of come to conclusions that the West wants. There was an interesting one, this whole issue of the chlorine attacks, which has been sort of the fallback position regarding mm-hmm. Syria, even when the sarin stuff has sort of has collapsed set of allegations against the Syrian government. Then they people say, well, there's been these chlorine attacks, but the problem with the chlorine attacks even make less sense because chlorine doesn't really kill anybody. I mean, unless you happen to be caught in a confined space when one of these things goes off, but you're probably going to be killed by the explosion anyway at that point. But here you have this. One of the cases that the UN investigated, mm-hmm. which was again pushed by the Al Qaeda and its propaganda agents, who so often pose as civil defense people, but they were claiming there was this chlorine attack on a village in 2014. They said they knew it because the chlorine was in a barrel bomb, and when chlorine is in a barrel bomb, it makes a different sound than other barrel bombs. And that was taken down sort of straight-facedly by the UN. But then seven different eyewitnesses came forward from the town and got through to the UN people and said the whole thing was staged. We were told to leave our homes because there was going to be this chlorine attack. The attack never happened. But then it was mm-hmm. alleged that it happened. So the UN had evidence. Had eyewitness evidence that the Al Qaeda people were staging these chemical attacks, but then the UN said, "Well, there are a couple others no one came forward to say they were staged, so we're going to believe them." So you have here a problem when you have a group like Al Qaeda, which is very willing to put obviously civilian innocent life at risk and destroy it. And they would do so to advance their cause, which mm-hmm. since they're extremists. So you can understand how they might have decided to pull something like this off. Now, that's not to say that I know that that happened, but there are serious questions, as Professor Postol has pointed out, about not only the logic, but the evidence that has been presented in connection with the April 4 incident. That would demand that a serious independent news media that we're supposed to have in the United States, but don't, would ask those questions and not simply make fun of people mm-hmm. who don't just buy in and get in lockstep with whatever the U.S. government's telling them.
Not just make fun, but attack. I mean, I've had some very interesting responses since my interview yesterday with Professor Postol. We'll talk about a little bit more because I have some questions. I'm not sure who to trust. If we can't trust the media, we can't trust the UN. We'll get to that in a minute. But on the recent chemical incident, whatever it was, on April 4, you note in your report that the White House photo released late last week showing the president and a dozen senior advisors monitoring the April 6 missile strike from a room at his Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida, which is obviously set up to look like the White House Situation Room. You write that was noteworthy in that neither CIA Director Mike Pompeo nor Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats was in the frame of that photograph. Why in particular do you find that noteworthy in this particular case?
Well, and it also goes to this, the fact that the White House then issued this so-called intelligence assessment on its own without mm-hmm. the imprimatur of the intelligence community itself. Mm-hmm. Now, what I've been told from inside the intelligence community and what others, like some of the ex-CIA people that I deal with a lot, mm-hmm. What they've been hearing as well from their former colleagues is that there was a great deal of dissent against this. This was not something that the analysts rolled over on, and certainly not in the time frame that President Trump was operating in. He declared that he knew who was behind this within a few hours.
Right.
And it became that then everyone else followed in, and the New York Times led their paper with, the U.S. says this was Assad. And so the time frame for the agency and other analysts to have gone through all the evidence, unless they had something that was entirely definitive, which I suppose is possible, although they haven't mentioned that.
A slam dunk, Robert Perry?
They'd have to have a slam dunk piece of evidence, right? Like Assad giving the order, the intercept, something mm-hmm. like that, which they have not said they have. So you had this problem where it appears that there was dissent within the agency, that Pompeo initially would not go along, although he was then sent out after my article. Mm-hmm. He was sent out to give a talk to some think tank in Washington, and during the Q&A, obviously he was going to be asked about Syria, and he said, "Oh yes, I looked the president in the eye, and I said that we have it," so forth. He described this dramatic meeting, which I'm told was just completely made up. Mm. It was in a position that he had to say it because once the president comes down to with a conclusion. And if you're the director of Central Intelligence and you want to differ with that, you basically have to resign.
Right.
And Pompeo didn't want to resign. So you have this problem where all the careerism of Washington sort of gets into sort of a lockstep when you have one of these situations. And instead of letting the analysts pursue the different possibilities, collect serious evidence. And even in the case of Obama and the so-called red line situation in August of 2013, mm-hmm. they didn't do anything for 9 days. It wasn't until it was the attack happened on August 21st, and it wasn't until August 30th that they started coming out and saying that Assad really did it. But even then, it's clear that the intelligence community was balking, and they had to sort of do another one of these White House intelligence assessments, not one from the community. So you had this. What happened there wasn't just that Obama tossed it to the Congress, mm-hmm. which he did, but the problem was he was being told by his intelligence community that they did not have the evidence on Assad. The British intelligence community was saying the same thing based on their analysis of the sarin, which they had obtained. So he knew that there wasn't good foundation for going into war again. Now, Obama, to his discredit, then refused to sort of clear up the record, and I've been very critical of him mm-hmm. for not laying out whatever the conclusions were. There's no reason that this stuff is kept hidden for years. And frankly, I've spent a lot of time trying to pry loose secrets from the Reagan years, or even before that. And the idea that these things become public after, 30 years or something isn't true. Mm. You have to sort of fight tooth and nail to get some of the stuff declassified from 40, 50 years ago.
Right.
So these things may just remain secret for indefinitely, at least our lifetimes. And so it's really wrong. I mean, there should be a demand here. And the mainstream press, the American press, should be leading it. That there should be as much transparency as possible when it comes to these issues of war and peace, and especially now that we're now escalating the situation into a possible nuclear confrontation with Russia, since Russia's active in Syria, and now apparently Trump has reversed himself and is thinking about setting up no-fly zones and other things which would require shooting down the planes operating over Syria, which include Russian planes,
yeah.
So the idea that we could get into a shooting war with Russia, but that our leadership will not explain what the evidence is, and the so-called independent news media will not demand that the government explain what the evidence is. This is a shocking shocking situation. The New York Times had a piece the other day where they sent someone to Moscow, I guess for the purpose of making fun of the Russians. And the guy came back with a story saying, ha ha, you know, it's almost like going into a world of alternative facts.
Mm-hmm.
Russia, they're talking about all these different possibilities on Syria when we all know it was done by Assad. I mean, I'm not sure the reporter understood how weird that was.
Well, it wasn't that weird.
There's more debate about what's going on in Russia than there is in the United States.
And it's not weird at all to him because, as you say, Robert Perry, it is just taken for granted that the official storyline is the official storyline. No question about it. And yet I'm left scratching my head asking why, you know, with all of these concerns that I've gone through, that you've gone through, neither you nor I know what actually happened. And frankly, it could have happened exactly as it has been told in that official narrative. But there is no discussion, none of the counter narrative. We played and it's not just U.S. media, it's really Western media. We played a clip on the show yesterday, former British ambassador to Syria, Robert Ford, on BBC News, actually questioning the narrative. That was nice to see, but I mean, very little of it anywhere else to be found. So, Robert Perry, in the minute or two we have left here, you came out of that mainstream corporate media. Why? What's the why is there no counter-narrative discussion at all in the corporate media, even to debunk, for example, the work like Professor Postol? Why aren't they, you know, if it's not true, why aren't they putting it up there and showing how Postol got it all wrong? What explains this?
Well, I think what explains it is that there's a desire to, first of all, be considered patriotic and supporting the U.S. In these foreign situations. There's a tremendous downside to your career if you ask too many questions. I even saw that back in the 80s. It was always a struggle to get the stories that became Iran-Contra out because there was a lot of resistance from my senior people at the Associated Press, some of whom were sort of World War II veteran types, and they didn't want to see their journalists undermining President Reagan, who they liked a lot. So there's a certain amount of that, just careerism, and journalists, like most bureaucrats, don't want to lose their jobs. But you've also had this other attitude, which is contempt for this any kind of alternative explanation of facts, and there is this view now that there's only one side to a story. Just a real quick thing. There was a good documentary done about this, the so-called Magnitsky case, which is a sort of a fundamental thing to the whole new Cold War. This guy Magnitsky, who was supposedly a lawyer, but he actually was an accountant, who died in a Russian prison, supposedly because he whistleblew on some scandal. There was a documentarian that did he went in there trying to do a pro-Magnitsky documentary, and then learned there were all these problems with the story that had been accepted in the West. And he did this really interesting documentary, tried to have it, he was supposed to be shown at the European Parliament in Brussels, and they barred it. They barred it because it didn't fit with the narrative that they wanted. And so here we have in the West this almost an attitude of that you're doing the right thing when you shut down these alternative storylines, because they're considered propaganda or something, fake news.
Right.
There's all this stuff now that's being thrown out about this, but it really means that you don't get to hear the other side of a story, and often the facts can be viewed differently. Even if one agrees on the facts, we often can see them differently, but that's not being allowed anymore, and anyone who tries to do it runs a grave risk of losing their career.
Last question for you, Robert Perry, since you brought this up earlier, if we can't trust the U.S. media, obviously they're not doing their job, or you suggest we can't trust the U.N., who can we believe? How do we find our way out of this quagmire when it comes to questions of war and peace like this in Syria? What are we to believe? Who can we turn to understand what's actually going on, particularly if the media is not going to do their job? Their main core mission, I believe, is to educate the electorate. who do we turn to, Robert Perry?
Well, I mean, it's a tough one. Obviously, there are many, many problems with the Internet, and I'm not going to defend the Internet, even though I've been working on it for 20-some years now. But you can find some reliable sources of information on the Internet that present conflicting points of view on some of these topics. Now, you have to be careful, obviously, but it's certainly true that you cannot simply say, I read the New York Times and I know what's going on anymore. I mean, I'm not sure you ever could. But it's certainly not true today. And I think anyone who thinks that is making a grave mistake in terms of their ability to understand the world around them. But I think you have to sort of try to get diverse sources of information. Even when some of those sources are being attacked by the mainstream, you have to make judgments on your own, whether this is solid stuff, if it's well documented, if it's well reported. And then trust your own judgment, not the judgment of the people that you see on CNN or MSNBC.
Robert Perry is the founder of one of those news sources, one of those independent investigative news sources, consortiumnews.com. Their tagline, independent investigative journalism since 1995. And yes, they are still at it. So thank you for that, Robert. You can also find him on the Twitters at Consortium News. Robert Perry, great speaking with you again. Hope to do it again soon.
Thanks, Brad.
All right, a quick break, and we're back with some breaking news that has come in while I've been talking to Robert Perry here. I'll check it out during the break. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. Don't go away. Remember when they used to play that song at 4th of July celebrations, Des?
Oh, yes.
They don't play that so much anymore for some reason.
Not
I don't
so much.
Understand.
Yeah.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Here's that breaking news I mentioned. A federal judge has blocked the Trump administration from enforcing a threat to take away funds from so-called sanctuary cities, the latest blow from the federal judiciary to President Donald Trump's immigration agenda, reports CNN. A ruling delivered on Tuesday, Judge William H. Orrick sided with Santa Clara, the city of San Francisco, and other cities who argued that a threat to take away federal funds from cities that do not cooperate with some federal immigration enforcement could be unconstitutional. It is a nationwide injunction, and Judge Orrick has blocked the government from enforcing this key portion of Trump's January executive order on immigration. Oh, he's going to be mad. That had ordered the Department of Homeland Security and the Justice Department to block cities who do not cooperate with federal immigration enforcement from receiving federal funds. Orrick's ruling does not find the policy unconstitutional, but he did find that counties and cities that challenged the law, it's actually not a law, it's an executive order, CNN, that they demonstrated they could face immediate irreparable harm if the policy were allowed to be put in place, and that their constitutional challenge could succeed once the case is fully heard. Threats to... They call it, so these so-called sanctuary cities, which is really a term that seems to have been invented, frankly, by Fox News and Bill O'Reilly. These are cities that don't have local police arrest people for being undocumented, which, would lead to a crime spike against immigrants, because criminals would figure out that, immigrants are too afraid to call the police. Go ahead and attack immigrants, mug them, rape them, whatever. They won't call the police for fear of being deported, which is why these cities in the first place say, all right, federal government, you can do your work. We'll do ours to fight crime, to fight local crime. In any case, these threats to defund sanctuary cities have been a key piece of Trump's immigration agenda. And Attorney General Jeff Sessions had sent letters last week to 9 cities requiring them to verify they are compliant with a piece of U.S. law mentioned in the executive order as a precondition of their receiving law enforcement grants that they applied for. But that precondition, as CNN notes, was actually put in place by the Obama administration. And mayors have said that that piece of law, that particular piece of what actually is a law, is something that they are already complying with. Now, Ernie Canning, our legal analyst at bradblog.com, also texts me as all of this is breaking to say, astounding. Judge Oreck's decision reveals that the Department of Justice did not respond to San Francisco and Santa Clara County's argument that Trump's order to strip sanctuary cities of federal funds violated the 10th Amendment prohibition against commandeering local jurisdictions. And this is something, you know, the 10th Amendment, these tenthers have said, you know, well, this is up to local, you know, state law. You can't have the federal government coming in and making these rules. They didn't even apparently respond to that argument. The judge found the Constitution vests the spending powers in Congress, not the president. So the order cannot constitutionally place new conditions on federal funds. Ernie Canning adds, so a court has once again shot down Trump's and Sessions' executive overreach. This also comes on the same day that Donald Trump has apparently folded like the paper tiger that he is in regard to a funding for his wall, at least before Friday, when the federal government must, by midnight on Friday, when the federal government must come up with a new budget or face a shutdown. Trump had been saying that he you know, would not allow a new budget bill if it didn't have funding for his wall that Mexico was supposed to pay for in the first place. He has backed off on that. He has completely folded, just as they did on health care. He pulled that. He has apparently now pulled the demand for funding of his border wall. Well, so much for the great negotiator. We already knew he was a crappy president, but he was supposed to be a tough negotiator. Turns out he's not much more than a paper tiger. Who knew? My thanks to Desi Doyen, my producer today, to Robert Perry of Consortium News, my guest today, and to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can, as ever, download it for free at bradblog.com. My great thanks to those of you who have stopped by bradblog.com/donate to help us continue to do what we try to do here every day. You can also drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com, and you can find, follow, and share us far and wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at The Brad Blog. That's it. We'll be back with you again tomorrow. Until then, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.